Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Here we go. A chilly Wednesday waiting for us. Not perhaps as chilly as yesterday was, but still chilly. And begs the question, why do I keep using the word chilly? I don't know. Maybe because it's chilly. Right now it is 47 degrees, going up to only 57. That's going to be toward the end of the day today. Tomorrow, highs of 59, 70% chance for showers. Then it clears out on Friday, highs of 64, and we go on a roller coaster, 70% chance for showers Saturday. Saturday is going to be a nice day, other than the rain, with highs near 70. So really, Friday, Saturday, those are the days you're going to want to take your cold preparations. Maybe Sunday, highs of 57, sunny. But then Monday, it turns cold. Highs Monday is only 40, 39 on Tuesday, 41 Wednesday, 46 Thursday. And a chance for freezes on the North Shore, maybe South Shore. And they don't quite know the timing of all of this. And they are actually talking about maybe a wintry mix. I don't know if it'll be here or maybe just up north in Yankee country in Baton Rouge, where we find Dr. Robert Hogan, professor in department and chair of political science at LSU. How you doing, Dr. Hogan?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm okay. How's everything way up north there in Baton Rouge?
Oh, it's going very well. We're enjoying the winter, the 3 weeks of it that we usually get,
Exactly.
It feels like January for once.
Man, I was in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago. It felt like January there. I'll tell you what, it was freezing, literally freezing.
I bet so.
Reflecting pool was frozen solid and all that kind of stuff. And the whatever that pond is in front of Congress, the Capitol, rather, that was frozen as well. Let's talk about the confirmation hearings that are going on.
And sure.
Let's talk about the role of the Congress in all of this. We'll talk about the process and we'll talk some of the practicalities of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Senate is tasked with receiving the designated people that the president would like to appoint to major cabinet posts. The president appoints all the major cabinet posts, 15 cabinet posts, including Secretary of State, Treasury, all the way down through education, agriculture, Veterans Affairs. And the way it works now, the Senate has to give its approval to these major heads of these cabinets, the cabinet departments, as well as some of the people at second in command. He has the hiring and firing ability and needs Senate approval for about 1,000 people or so. And they're the people who control these departments. And there's always a tension. The president wants people who will do his bidding, so to speak, that accept his ideological perspective on the way these departments should be run. And so he wants people who will be loyal to him, but will hopefully do a good job in those positions. And Congress's responsibility, in this case, the Senate, a majority have to give their approval in the Senate, examine the nominees to confirm them, and they look at their backgrounds to see if they're qualified and see also if they will have fidelity to the interests of the departments that they're being asked to run. So there's always this inherent tension there, and Congress will most often, likely in the past, has done its responsibility of making certain that these are qualified people who are fit for these positions. So that's the way the system works. What's maybe very different this time is what you saw yesterday in the Congress, in the Senate hearings for the Trump's choice for the defense secretary, Mr. Hegseth. This was pretty unusual, I would say. I mean, a lot of the debate, or a lot of the questioning had to do with his issues of his character, of his personal failings, of his position on controversial issues. The Democrats went away from that, thinking this is not someone who's even qualified. And in fact, historically, you have to look. It's hard to find someone who is less qualified for defense secretary than this nominee. This is someone who has experience in the military, who has served in the military, the National Guard in Minnesota, but has never held any higher, you know, level office in the military or rank in the military that we are accustomed to seeing previous designees or appointees have. There are legitimate questions about his judgment, his character, his qualifications, and Democrats were there as a loyal opposition to bring these things out, and the Republicans were there to try to provide support to their president's nominee. So we see this playing out, but I do think we're seeing something that's very different than we've seen in the past. Given his qualifications, it's like, why is Trump appoint? If you look at his other appointees, look at his appointee for Secretary of State, which is Marco Rubio, someone who has a long career in the U.S. Senate, a long career of service, who has built up expertise in foreign relations in the Senate. That nominee is not going to have any problem, and Democrats will be fully supportive of him. This is someone who I think Trump sees as a loyalist to Mr. Hegseth, and someone that will do his bidding. And a lot of Democrats are saying that's going a little too far. We want someone who has qualifications and can earn the respect of the millions of people that work for the Defense Department and who serve in combat. One of the key things here you got to consider is you want to appoint someone who will have the respect and can get things done. It is not a simple task to run an organization of this magnitude. And I think that there are real legitimate questions about whether or not he has the qualifications.
So when it comes to being a cabinet secretary, and I think a lot of people automatically fall into line of either winning or losing. You support President Trump, you're either with him or you're against him. And they support Hegseth, and they don't maybe know about his qualifications. As Secretary of Defense, what will his job be? Let's look at it from that angle.
Sure. It is to run the Defense Department. it is a multi-faceted task. It's running a large organization. It is dealing with budgets. It's dealing with all sorts of things that you deal with running a large organization. And the concern is that he doesn't have experience in doing that kind of thing. But it also has to do with providing he will be the person who speaks to the president concerning military options. Every sort of military possibility that is considered involves the Secretary of Defense. He is in charge of the generals. In the United States, we have civilian control of the military, and he is that person. He is the person in charge that tells the generals what to do, tells all of the military what to do. And so it is probably, I would argue, in the present day, the most critical of the cabinet secretaries. And, and the question is, do you want someone that is loyal to Trump? Or do you want someone who has the qualifications to know how to get the job done? What is so critical here, it seems to me, is that we're in a situation where Trump wants to have a disruptor in that position. Okay. And Hegseth himself even said this at the hearing yesterday. He's going to be a disruptor. The question is, how do you balance someone who's going to be a disruptor with someone who can actually get something done? I think a lot of Democrats probably are thinking to themselves, let him appoint this person. This person will not be able to get anything done. He doesn't have the know-how. That sounds like a dangerous path in many respects.
Let me read two quick texts here, Doc, and then we'll take a break and come back. One of them says, what qualifies a senator who comes from a cattle ranching background or a senator who is formerly a family practice doctor to determine qualifications of a candidate seeking the position of Secretary of Defense or Secretary of Transportation, et cetera? Another text says Trump wants loyalists above anything else, doesn't care about qualifications. This will be another clown show where there's a revolving door of people in and out of these agencies and nothing will get done. That's a sampling of the texts. I'm getting. You can send your thoughts in to the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. We'll talk about some other cabinet positions when we come back with Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, 623 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 627 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. As far as process goes, the hearings are happening now. The inauguration is Monday. J.D. Vance gets sworn in as vice president on Monday. He would be the deciding vote in the Senate, correct? What's needed to confirm a cabinet secretary, Professor?
A majority vote in the U.S. Senate, and then the current breakdown is 53 Republicans to 47 Democrats. If there's a party line vote, the president will get all of his nominees confirmed. So that's why so much attention yesterday was put on the senator from Iowa, Joni Ernst, who sits on that panel.
You're reading ahead,
and what
Professor,
she was going to do.
That's what I wanted to get to in the next minute here that we have left. She's a survivor of sexual assault.
Right.
Pete Hegseth has been battling allegations of sexual assault. He says he was cleared of any charges, but she's up for re-election in 2026. So how afraid is she of being primaried? What kind of pressure, what kind of power does President Trump have, and how likely is that to affect this vote?
No, I think what you saw is you saw her capitulate. I mean, she brought up serious questions, and she said she was going to go into the committee with some serious and important questions. She did not go after him in a way that you would think she would. She came out yesterday saying that she was going to give him his support. So that effectively means that it looks like he has a glide path to confirmation. And not only it's her vote, but a lot of people were looking to her. There's still four or five U.S. Republican senators on the fence here. But they were probably looking to see what she was going to do. But there was a tremendous campaign in her own state. Potential candidates to challenge her sort of were saber rattling, saying that they were thinking of running. And there was, a great sort of grassroots effort as well. So those things mattered. President Trump is extraordinarily powerful, probably the most powerful president the United States has ever had. And this is showing how that manifests itself.
They're going to hate me for asking you one more question at 6:30, but I got to. And Professor, if you can be brief, please, to keep me out of trouble.
Sure.
But when it comes to a third of the Senate's up for re-election every 2 years, right? 2026.
Mm-hmm, right.
Does President Trump's power extend to senators that are not up for re-election in 2026 or not?
Well, I think so. I mean, a lot of senators who aren't up for re-election. They know that voters have memories, and some of the other senators have other machinations about running for governor or higher office themselves. So, I think he has a lot of influence because he has a huge impact on party activists within his party.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:47, 13 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Just about the middle of the month, 30 days after September. Yes, right. Just about the middle of the month, 31 days in January. Today is January 15th. It's going to be another chilly day with highs only going up to 57. And that's going to be kind of towards sunset. 60% chance for showers today, 70% tomorrow. And that rain's going to come in later on in the afternoon. They're saying maybe even after tonight. So I don't know why they put that chance for showers in. It turns cold next week. Let's move on to Bo Jones, if we will, president and CEO of the Water Institute. How you doing, Bo?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How are you?
I don't know if that's your real name or not, but I'd hire you just for that name alone to be the CEO of the Water Institute.
It is indeed my name.
Let's talk about
Louisiana born and bred.
Let's talk about, I figured that. Let's talk about blue carbon, because I think a lot of people want to know, what is blue carbon?
Yeah, appreciate the question, Tommy. I mean, basically blue carbon is the ability of wetlands and kind of water and aquatic habitats to pull down carbon out of the atmosphere and store it for time, right? And so Louisiana wetlands and wetlands around the world are critical ecosystems as a part of the carbon cycle around the world. They pull down, something like 30% of the carbon from the atmosphere. So
wait, take me through that again. I'm trying to get this straight.
So blue carbon, right, is a concept that Everybody remembers, you know, back at Shaw High School, y'all talked about photosynthesis, right?
Right.
And so photosynthesis is the ability of plants to, you know, turn carbon dioxide into what they need and, you know, let oxygen go. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in coastal habitats, the wetlands that are all around Louisiana, the forests that are all around Louisiana, around the world, through that process, they are pulling down carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it in their roots and their woody material and in the ground. Wetland habitats, which make up about 3% of the planet, sequester about 30% of the world's carbon that is pulled down out of the atmosphere.
How does that compare and contrast with carbon capture as it's being presented or being developed?
Yeah, fantastic question, Tommy. You know, so carbon capture, as you generally hear it, or carbon capture utilization and storage, or direct air carbon capture, these are industrial-based solutions, right? Some technology that is either preventing carbon from going into the atmosphere or, once it's out there, pulling it back down. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about with blue carbon, and it's not just we, you know, scientists and policymakers around the world are navigating it, is how are we supporting and incentivizing the natural processes of plants and nature and nature-based solutions to pull down carbon, just like that technology. So forests all around the world are pulling down carbon. People are protecting forests for that reason, planting new forests. And what we're talking about here is in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, what are the opportunities for protecting and building new marshland for that carbon benefit?
Is there any way to determine what kind of carbon gets captured by nature in total, not just blue carbon, but forest trees, et cetera? And I'm just trying to compare and contrast how nature can do, I'm guessing, Bo, and I might be wrong here, far more than any type of direct carbon capture could ever accomplish. Am I onto anything here or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the question goes right to the core of the issue, right? Is that, you know, the carbon cycle is something that existed, you know, long before we create industrial processes, right? So the world has its own lungs. It has its it sucks down carbon. It expels carbon. It cycles it through the oceans, right? So it is something that goes on. The system is complete without us. Now, when we've added things in, obviously we've had to augment things. But to give you a sense of scale, Tommy, right? So there's a lot of, you know, many of your listeners, you know, will get on a flight, and the flight will say, you hop on a United flight, and it says, your flight uses this much carbon dioxide. Do you want to offset that? Well, typically what you're doing is you're paying some fee to, you know, a forest around the world that is either protecting that forest from getting cut down and providing the financial support for that, or providing financial resources to plant new forests. In Louisiana, what the science has shown is that if you take 1 acre of a Louisiana wetland, right, and you compare that to 1 acre of a forest, a terrestrial forest, that the Louisiana wetland is about 80 times, sequesters about 80 times as much carbon, right? Wow. So there's a $2 billion plus dollar market in internationally around carbon sequestration naturally, and that's generally around forests. And what we're dealing with here in Louisiana and on the Gulf Coast is potentially on net an 80-time multiplier there.
So 80-time multiplier when it comes to capturing carbon, it restores the coast, it prevents coastal erosion, and also serves as for want of a better phrase, a breakwater when it comes to storm surge in times of hurricanes, et cetera, right? I'm on anything here, Bo?
Oh, you're right onto it, right? And that's one of the things, you know, when you go back to what you would traditionally hear as carbon capture or some of the industrial base, there's no unquestionably a carbon benefit, right? We're pulling carbon down or we're storing carbon. And one of the things that's really important that the state and the work that we're doing is you know, we've started under the Jindal administration, have done a lot of this work under John Bel Edwards, and we're continuing to do this work under Governor Jeff Landry. And what the state recognizes is exactly what you just hit on, Tommy, which is that there are multiple benefits for protecting and conserving Louisiana wetlands. I mean, you don't have to go far to know the aesthetic and the recreational value of them, how much we love being in and around the wetlands. But as you talked about the storm surge, the ecosystem services, and one of the things we're trying to do, and look, we're not an advocacy organization, but what we're trying to do is make sure that the full suite of benefits of Louisiana is not only recognized by, you know, your listeners who are, you know, in the area, but internationally and nationally as well, to recognize that this is a comprehensive benefit.
Let me take a break, Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute. This seems like a no-brainer to me, so I want to come back and talk about where it stands now and how do you get more funding for it, because if you get 80 times the payback as you do on a rainforest, it would seem like this would be the way to go. 6:54, 6 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Less than a minute left with Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute here on WWL. 1 acre of wetlands can capture the carbon of 80 acres of rainforest. How, Bo, do you get this funded, this blue carbon project?
Yeah, you know, right now, the state of Louisiana and the federal government and industry around the state are investing heavily in the science and policy necessary to understand this. But, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that's important is that landowners and individuals around the state of Louisiana recognize that maybe the traditional notions of value for our wetlands, there may be more than we knew, right? And so we have found carbon in the soil in Louisiana wetlands that are between 1,500 and 3,000 years old, right? So these are incredibly valuable habitats for not only the people here, but for around the world. And I think it's important that people recognize that.
Hope you come back. Thank you. Cloudy start. Going to be a cloudy day today. Highs only of 57, so it might even feel a little cooler than it did yesterday, although the temperature is going to be a little bit warmer. Then a chance for showers comes in later on tonight around 10 o'clock. Lingers into tomorrow. Clears out by Friday. Highs of 64. Then warms to 68 on Saturday. Then the real cold front comes through, and we're talking highs on Monday of only 40 degrees with freeze warnings for the North Shore and maybe even the South Shore, and maybe a wintry mix of snow or ice or something on Tuesday, but they'll have to watch that. It's all about the timing. Bruce Jenelson joins us now, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Our good friend previously worked in the State Department on a Middle East peace process. Bruce, good morning. Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you as well, Tommy.
And I don't know if I spoke to you enough, but we really do value your time because you're not just in an ivory tower. You worked with these people. You know how it works in Washington and in the Middle East, and you were involved in all of this. Take us back, Bruce, if you can, for some context, because so much has happened since October of 2023, I guess it was, right?
Yeah, that was a real turning point. You know, I mean, back in the 90s, there were some breakthroughs. The Israelis and Palestinians started moving towards peace agreements, kicked off by the Norwegians, but then led by the Americans, and a lot of on and off over the years. And there had been some, you know, I'll call them small wars between Israel and Gaza, but this is of a totally different scale. You know, on October 7th, more Jews were killed than in any single day since the Nazi Holocaust. Very, you know, traumatic for Israel. And then the war that Israel's launched since then, death tolls are in the 45,000. Some are Hamas fighters, but an awful lot are civilians. And, you know, it's been a huge humanitarian crisis there, as well as the Israelis still being, I have friends in Israel who, talking to the other day, and at 3 in the morning they're getting sirens because of rocket attacks from the Houthis in Yemen, still from the Palestinians. So both sides, you know, you don't want to compare suffering. It was more both sides are suffering.
Bruce, I wanted to say this and I forgot.
So it's a new year, 2025, and you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Initially, when I knew you were coming on, but I forgot it when you came on, and that is talk about, you know, now that Jimmy Carter's funeral is over and the flags are at half staff, that's going to change. That's a story for another day. But talk about the importance of what he accomplished with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, I think it was, right?
Yeah, it was a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, the very first peace agreement since Israel was founded in 1948 between Israel and an Arab country. And look, we're almost 50 years later, and it stood up. I mean, you know, that's a pretty good record, you know, for anywhere in the world, let alone the Middle East. And there have been a lot of tensions between Israel and Egypt. You know, Egypt is, you know, obviously not happy with what Israel's been doing in Gaza and a variety of other issues. And, you know, all presidents have, you know, strengths and weaknesses. There are some parts of Carter's foreign policy that people are critical of. But the breakthrough there was this human touch he had. There's this story, and if you go to the Carter Center in Atlanta, he has the letters posted there, where it was about to break up. The two leaders were angry with each other. And he went to each one at Camp David, each had their own cabin, and he said, let's talk about our grandkids, right? Let's talk about not just our current politics, but the future. And, you know, Israel signed a peace treaty with Jordan in 1994. That stood up now for 30 years. But Egypt, you know, long had been the most powerful country in the Middle East, and so that's a huge achievement. And without that, things would be even worse than they are today.
And Anwar Sadat paid for that with his life, did he not?
He did, and a couple of years later, he was assassinated by some extremists in his own country at a military parade, and he paid for it with his own life. And, you know, Sadat was also someone, and Begin. Begin was, you know, call it a, you know, very right-wing radical when Israel was founded, and even opposed some of the deals that Israel's first president and prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, made. And Sadat had also been a military commander who'd fought Israel in 1973. You know, just like Yitzhak Rabin, you know, in the 1990s, some of these, when you've been a military person and you know the risk and costs of war, it sometimes makes you more oriented to trying to find peace. And that's what happened with Sadat.
We're going to take a break and pick it up with the current situation when we return. But the reason I brought that up, it's all about context. And if, say, a guy like Netanyahu was president, there is no way he would have negotiated a peace term with Egypt. What do you think?
No, you know, right now Netanyahu, frankly, he's trying to stay in office because he faces some serious prosecution for his own alleged criminal offenses. And, you know, many people in Israel, including, you know, people that are top former military officials, the former head of the Shin Bet, one of their big spy agencies, has said this war needs to end, not just because of the humanitarian toll for Gaza, but because for Israel's interest. And Netanyahu very much, and he's you know, totally beholden to this extreme group on his right wing that not only want to, you know, get rid of the Palestinians, but want to change Israeli society so that they impose their ultra version of Judaism on the rest of Israel. So, you know, he's thinking real more about himself and his country, frankly, in my view.
Is it accurate, Bruce, to say before we go to the break that both Begin and Sadat expended a lot of political capital to try to bring peace to the region, and Sadat ultimately expended his life to bring peace to the region, trying to do what was in the best interest of everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Begin, you know, survived a few years later. He stayed prime minister for a few years after that and then had some other issues and problems. But he had to come back and tell the people who were his extremists, you know, that he didn't cave, you know, he didn't go soft. He did what was in the best interest of the country. And so it didn't cost him his life. It did cost Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli leader in the 1990s, his life. Same thing, assassinated by somebody who was, ultra extremist. But, you know, that's what leadership is all about. You know, seeing the big picture, seeing the future. You know, playing the politics the best you can, but not making them, the determining force when you see there's a better way for your country and your people.
And I just want to make that point because I don't know if that exists in 2025 or not, or we'll see. We'll talk more about the agreement when we come back. 722 Traffic Now, WWL. Back with Bruce Jennelson, our friend, director of a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process. Before we get to, and we only have a little bit of time left, instead of focusing on the details of this, because that's likely to change, I'd rather focus on a process, Bruce, because you got a new president being inaugurated on January 26th. Who's negotiating this, and how binding is whatever deal they come up with after January 20th?
Yeah, they're talking about they're close to a deal on the hostages and ceasefire. I know the Biden people have been coordinating with the Trump people on this, you know, whatever the other tensions are between the presidents and the transition teams. And it may well be the combination of the work the Biden people have done and some pressure from President-elect Trump, including, by the way, on Netanyahu, because Trump wants a deal. And if Hamas is cooperative and Netanyahu is not, then while he supports Netanyahu in other ways, he may pressure him. So there seems to be some coordination. It's not like the Biden people are doing this and not coordinating with the Trump people, at least on this issue.
When it comes to Carter, going back to him, does Biden have any part of the here's what I'm trying to say in my own clumsy way in the minute that we have left. Bruce, we all know that Iran refused to release the hostages until Reagan was sworn in, right? That was their last shot at Jimmy Carter, if I remember history correctly. And I just wonder, does any of that play into this with Biden or not?
You know, I think it does. I think Trump would like a deal like Reagan's, and he can say, and, you know, he'll claim all the credit. The Biden people may claim the credit. My sense is if there's a deal, the credit is really because of the two of them. And even on the hostage deal, I mean, part of the, you know, frustration of Carter was there was a lot of stuff going on before the election where the Reagan people were telling the Iranians, don't make a deal, we'll make a better deal with you, we'll lift the grain embargo. So we'll get more details, you know, if there is a deal. But I'm afraid it's another one of these Charlie Brown and Lucy and the football things, and it may be pulled out at the 11th hour.
And when it comes to history being ugly, Nixon did put off the Vietnam peace negotiations for re-election. That's a fact, is it not?
It is absolutely a fact, yes.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Bruce. Sometimes history is an ugly thing, but it is true. Bruce Jennelson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process. Not trying to take a shot at Nixon, just reminding everybody that the truth is sometimes an inconvenient thing, and you can't just let it go away because you don't want to hear it. We'll come back, talk about the homeless situation in New Orleans right now. 7:30 on a button, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8 on this chilly Wednesday morning. It'll be cloudy today, too, so it may actually feel a bit colder than it was yesterday, what with no sunshine and so forth. A chance for rain tonight that extends into tomorrow. Highs of 59, then clear on Friday, or at least partly cloudy, highs of 64, warmer on Saturday in advance of a cold front. Then it really does turn cold, and you heard Peyton Malone talk about maybe a wintry mix on Tuesday, and if it does snow and the kids are in school, let them go out and play in it. I know my kid was in school one of the years it snowed, and they forced them to sit inside and watch, and you know they're not paying attention to anything that's going on. Just let them go out and play in the snow. All right, we're talking about the move by Governor Jeff Landry to open that facility at 5601 France Road. The efforts to move the homeless is underway. Joe Heron Mueller joins us now, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans, to talk about it. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm all right. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. Let me say this. Yesterday, and I'll stand up to what I said. Yesterday, I said nothing is perfect. There is no perfect solution. It seemed like the governor may be on the right track here because he's not dispersing people. He's keeping them in one location. There are details to be worked out after talking to Leslie Harris, you know, with getting the working homeless to their jobs, to medical appointments, et cetera. And I don't know about ending it after Mardi Gras, but tell me, am I wrong on any of this or your thoughts as to the governor's plan? And then we'll go from there. And I'm not trying to argue. I'm just saying, as a guy who's just an observer, it would seem like it's not a terrible idea. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, when we're looking at homelessness, we need quick solutions can be very appealing, but we need to make sure that we're staying focused, especially as a coordinator of homeless service providers across Orleans and Jefferson Parish, on the long view. What do we need to do to really effectively address homelessness, not just today, but in the long haul? And to that end, you know, we need to have a dialogue with the governor and his staff. We need to be working in partnership with the city and service providers to find proven and cost-effective solutions. That really means permanent housing for those who are working. often it's they're experiencing homelessness, they need a little bit of support, a few months of rental assistance to get back on their feet. If they're folks like many of the folks in our city who have been homeless for long periods of time, they need permanent rental assistance because their disabilities are the major contributing factor to their homelessness. So we have solutions like that. We've been working on those types of solutions, and it is very effective. However, you know, new people fall into homelessness because housing costs are very high. Anybody who's got a rental payment or a mortgage knows that. That said, in the short term, shelter, low barrier shelter that is voluntary, that is respects the dignity and rights of the people who are there, can be effective at helping facilitate an end to homelessness through housing. It's not the solution, but it can be part of an approach that is effective.
So ideally, what would you like to see? Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. All right. I just noticed the time. We got to look at traffic. We're talking to Joe Heron Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. I mentioned my thoughts about the governor's plan and what happens from here and my concerns and some things that needed to be hashed out. And when we come back, we'll see what Joe thinks. And a Unity of Greater New Orleans, ideally, if they could come up with the plan and get it funded, what it would look like. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Joe Heron Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans, about the governor's plan that is underway and people are being relocated to the center on France Road, warehouse on France Road, however you want to describe it. I asked you before the break, Joe, in Unity of Greater New Orleans' eyes, what would the perfect plan be? Because it's hard, or the best plan be. It's hard to come up with anything that's perfect. But ideally, if you could write the script, what would it look like to solve the homeless situation in New Orleans, or at least deal with it?
Well, yeah, you know, we have to work with whatever the situation is right now, not in an ideal world. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that optimally, you want to work to navigate people who fall into homelessness as rapidly as possible. We have a situation now where there are many people who are unsheltered and who are living in various parts of the city. You have to have outreach workers that are competent and that are engaged with folks and that are building trust. And you need shelters that flow, where people can go into a shelter, get short-term assistance, and quickly move out of that shelter into permanent housing because there are units available and vouchers available to help them get that. That's something that we've been working on with our partners at the City of New Orleans in Jefferson Parish. And making sure that folks who are experiencing homelessness across our community, whether they're unaccompanied adults or whether they're families with children, have options. We're moving forward with the transitional center. We've got to make sure that when folks get in there and that there's a plan for them to get out, that there are housing slots available, that they're being connected and navigated to affordable, secure, quality housing in our community. Because by and large, the folks who experience homelessness in our community are from our community. These are New Orleanians. These are folks who are local and have fallen into homelessness. By and large, we are not talking about folks who have traveled to New Orleans from somewhere else to experience homelessness. It's really not to say that never happens, but it is by far the outlier of situations. So that's what we need to have. And we need to have continued wraparound services to make sure that people don't fall back into homelessness. And we have good success with that. Over the last 15 months we have been working in partnership on an unsheltered initiative with the city and Travelers Aid and other partners, we've housed on average 100 people a month. That's not just people from the street, but that's people across all situations of homelessness. Unity and our partners have housed on average 100 people a month over the last 15 months. And 822 of them, I believe, were housed through the city's unsheltered initiative.
Thank you. We're out of time, Joe. I appreciate your time. I really do, and your insights. And we'll talk to you again because this is not going to go away anytime soon. Joe Herron-Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. We'll talk to Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member. We come back about the same thing. It is 8:15 now on this chilly Wednesday morning, and it's going to be chilly all day today. A lot of clouds, so it's going to feel maybe a little bit colder than it did yesterday. And we got some real cold weather coming up next week, and we'll keep you updated as to all of that. We're talking about Governor Landry's plan to start this homeless open. It actually is open, homeless center on France Road. And we've spoken about it yesterday. We're talking about it today. We just got off the phone with Joe Herron-Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. And now Eugene Green joins us, our friend, New Orleans City Council member. Good morning, Council member. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing just fine. Good to talk to you and your listeners.
Thank you. One thing that I think is important is that we talk about the homeless, and I think we need to make sure that everybody understands that are homeless people. And sometimes that gets lost. And I know it sounds silly, Eugene, but sometimes I don't think people realize that they don't want to see it. They want it out of sight, out of mind. But these are people that have issues and have problems and need help. So let's talk.
They also live in the United States of America. So we have to abide by certain rules and regulations, or at least the city does. So that's been our concern also, because, you know, we've been relocating people for the last year. Over 750 people relocated. That's why there's no longer a Chapatulas encampment, no longer a Claiborne Avenue encampment. So we kind of know how to do it and respect the rights of the people who are being relocated. And that's our concern as much as anything else, in addition to the fact that the nearby communities should have been given some notice, at least had some idea that it was going to happen. Maybe the input could have been sought. At the end of the day, the governor controls the land. He controls the funding. He has the executive order power. It would have happened anyway, but that's what you hear on the city side, concern for the nearby residents in terms of not having them have a plan, and also making sure that the rights of those who are relocated are respected according to the Constitution.
The residents near France Road in your district, right?
Yes, Pontchartrain Park, Gentilly Woods, but also people forget that there are businesses along France Road and Old Gentilly Road and Chef Highway, and communication with them is important. It's not great when they just find out in the media that there's going to be an encampment for 200 people on France Road and they don't have any say in it at all. I think sometimes people confuse a neighborhood having say with a neighborhood having veto power. They weren't going to be able to veto it. You know, but the bottom line is that there was no communication. But it's open right now, Tommy. At the end of the day, it started at 5 a.m. They're picking up people. Our job now is to work with the state, provide whatever support is necessary. We haven't been asked, but as a city, we will, through our own Office of Homeless Services and Strategies, work with the state to provide the services that are necessary to help the people who are there transition properly back into society.
Because the people that live near where the homeless are being moved from aren't necessarily happy about it either. And that's where the, I guess, not my backyard thing, however you want to phrase it, comes in. What is the optimum solution here? Permanent housing? And I guess let's take a step back. A lot of people, or some of them, that are homeless, do you have any percentage are working?
No, and I'm going to find out soon, because according to those who are working, additional assistance, which is designed to get them into housing quicker, so they're going to prioritize them. But no, at the end of the day, I don't really know that I think that percentage is as high as people think. Now, remember, we're talking about those who are unhoused, who are living outside on the street. Mm-hmm. We have many more people who are technically homeless. They stay at the New Orleans Mission, the Ozanam Inn, Odyssey House, and places like that. This was to remove people from the streets, especially from the French Quarter and Superdome area, for example. So those numbers are going to be smaller than the overall homeless numbers, but I don't have the number of people who are working. I don't know that I think that the people who are working who are living on the streets are housed, are working in jobs. Honestly, because I go to homeless encampment cleanups every week, every other week. We do them every other Wednesday, and very quietly, we've relocated hundreds of people. But I can't say that I've talked to people who said, I just got back this morning from work. I mean, we have a mental health challenge that's on the streets of New Orleans, on the streets of urban areas. People move here because there are services available to them. Even Unity of New Orleans has said that 75% of the people that they've relocated have mental health challenges. We're not going to overcome that in the very near future, but it is something to recognize. It's not because the vast majority of people are not out on the streets living in the cold, living at corners because the rent is too high or because their jobs don't give them the stability to be able to get into apartments. It's important to just recognize, because part of humanity is providing services based on what you see as a need or what you understand to be a need. At the end of the day, we have a mental health challenge crisis on the streets.
A lot of different angles to it. I was going by what your colleague, Councilmember Leslie Harris, told me yesterday about providing transportation for people from the governor's facility, I'll call it that, on France Road to get to work and also to medical appointments. We'll pick it up here. We come back with Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member. 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Councilmember Eugene Green about the governor's facility to house the homeless until after Mardi Gras. So when it comes to the governor's plan, Councilman, do you think it's a good idea? Would you like to get everybody together at the table and maybe talk about some tweaks here or there? Is this a sustainable thing for after Mardi Gras? Thoughts on all of that?
I think that the community and elected officials, for example, could offer strong suggestions and get community support, for example. For example, when you have something like this that you announce on Monday and it's going to open on Wednesday, there are people out there who are sincere. There are churches. There are people who live in communities who say, well, look, I might be willing to help, depending on what the need is, volunteer support, having a facility where people can come and do certain things, for example, at the nearby churches. But that option wasn't presented. I think that's the biggest resentment that you have. I think everybody recognizes that it was unhealthy. It is unhealthy for people to be living at the corner of Elysian Fields and Decatur Street in a sleeping bag in the cold, especially as we're going to experience next week. We were working in that right direction. So now it's open, Tommy, and to your listeners, it's open. So my job now is to work with the community, but also to offer services to the state of Louisiana, involving potentially the community, to make sure that those services are provided. I did visit the site. I was told that there's going to be a shuttle that takes everybody to whatever their appointment is, to whatever their need is. We want to make that happen. There might have been people in the community who can participate and support this shuttle process, you know, depending on how it works. But nobody was given that input. But it's now open. So we have to do what we can to make sure that it's the best service provided, that it focuses on humanity, it focuses on the needs of the community, and those services that are needed to get delivered. Tommy, I appreciate this time because I want all of our listeners to know it's going to always be a challenge in New Orleans relative to homelessness. Our weather is good, save the month of January and February at certain times, and people come here all the time because of our hospitality, because of the services that we provide, and there are significant services. It's not a mistake that in other areas around New Orleans, nobody has really a homeless shelter. It's because they tell them that there are resources nearby, and there are in the city of New Orleans. So we're going to be dealing with the issue, but the idea of people sleeping on the streets and in abandoned houses where they are dying of overdoses and where they're subject to crime and things like that, we also have to balance the fact that that is not acceptable in a city such as ours.
Let me talk about Mardi Gras with you real quick. What with the SEER 1 rating, what's that likely to look like, Eugene, and how is that likely to change? And I'll go back to the conversation I had with Arthur Hardy, and he said, you know, a guy in a mask dragging an ice chest down the street, that's a SEER 1 nightmare, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that's exactly kind of what Mardi Gras is. How do you balance all of that?
Well, I think that you kind of asked it in the way that's going to make it a challenge for me to answer. I don't know exactly how you balance it. At the end of the day, our goal is to have as many people possible as possible together to celebrate and to stand outside of a passing vehicle on corners on the streets. However, I will say this, I'm very confident that the federal government, working with the city and state, is going to have in place the maximum amount of security. There are going to be so many law enforcement officers here. And those concerns that you mentioned are very important. People should call in what they see. If you suspect that something is going on, if you suspect and you see somebody with an ice chest and you think that that is something that needs to be looked at, there are cameras in place. There are going to be more cameras in place. There are going to be more nearby officers. They'll inquire. They'll ask. But I'll ask all of our citizens to be on alert and recognize that in this time, very honestly, be sure to kind of do the right thing and, you know that you could be watched. If an officer asks you something, it's not because he's profiling you in particular. It's something that needs to be done to keep us all secure. If you can't drive down a particular street, it's not because the city of New Orleans is closing down. It's because there are security issues that need to be addressed. It's going to be a challenging time, but we're going to come through it like we come through it with every major event in the city of New Orleans. Mardi Gras is going to be fun. The Super Bowl is going to be fun. And then guess what? Right after that, we're going to prepare. Right after Mardi Gras, we're going to prepare for Jazz Fest and those 100,000 people that come in town. And it's going to be successful.
Yep, French Quarter Fest, too. Thank you, Councilmember Eugene Green. And the only thing I would add is that if you don't feel safe at Mardi Gras, don't go. But that's always your right and your option to do it. But I personally don't want to see it changed so substantially that it's like a lockdown area like Washington, D.C. was before the inauguration. We'll take a break, come back, and talk with Devin Bartolotto about the New Orleans terror attack. She's an anchor at Channel 4. I'll explain more on the other side of the news here on WWL. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I was saying before the break, I wish somebody would take Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and put it together chronologically with the flash forwards and flashbacks so you could watch a story beginning to end. And that's fiction, of course, but in real life, Devin Bartolotto, WWL Louisiana reporter and anchor, has kind of done that with the timeline of the Bourbon Street attack. Good morning, Devin. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. How are the kids? Or kid?
Kid. She's good. She doesn't stop moving. I just dropped her off at school.
How old? Now
she's like a little less than a year and a half old, like almost 17 months old, so she's talking up a mile a minute and
change
moving
your life.
All over the place.
Change your life just a little bit, huh, Mom?
It's so much fun. I love
it. Okay, it'd save her every moment because it'll be gone in a heartbeat. Let's talk about what you put together here, because I think it's interesting the way you put the whole story together with Shamsuddin Jabbar's attack and when it first started, when he was first captured on video. So I'm going to turn it over to you. Devin, you're a good storyteller. Have at it.
Oh, my. All right. Well, so this was kind of a collaborative thing between producer Tori Josie and I. She's our producer at 10 o'clock, and she is an EarthCam lover. So mm-hmm. She always put the EarthCam in our shows and has for years. So when she heard that some of these videos were starting to be released and we had a little bit better idea of a timeline of when Jabbar was in New Orleans, she started to take a look. Now, the thing with the EarthCam is unless somebody takes a screenshot, after 24 hours, it disappears forever. So she was entirely reliant on what photos people had taken screenshots of in the 24 hours after this attack and what they've taken videos of as well. And she was able to go through and find little pieces where we see the cooler that at least one of the coolers that Jabbar dropped off on Bourbon Street, and also a video of him riding a bike through the French Quarter in October. So do you want me to take a look at the day of or start way back?
Let's start way back. Tell me the whole story. We had a couple of minutes here.
So, I mean, we know that he came on Halloween to kind of scope things out. And what Tori and I did was combined with the video that the FBI released, which is recorded on Meta Glasses on Halloween of him biking down Bourbon Street. We kind of pieced this all together in a timeline. So we know that on Halloween, he came in the afternoon. He was riding through the French Quarter on a bike. He was recording on Meta Glasses first at Bourbon in St. Louis, and he kind of takes a whole ride through the French Quarter. So we see him on the EarthCam at Bourbon in St. Peter at 4:25 p.m., he went down Royal, down Canal. We see him crossing Canal at Camp Street, then turn onto Charters. And the FBI released a photo of him on the security camera at 4:54 p.m. So we know for at least an hour he was riding through the French Quarter on Halloween in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Then we know he came back on November 10th. We only have one photo that was released yesterday of that. So Tori and I are kind of keeping an eye on what else might be released. And she's also currently combing through whatever surveillance videos that she can find from the French Quarter right now of that date to try and find things.
What was he doing in Gonzales? Do you know?
So we've been trying to figure that out, and we don't actually have video of what he was doing in Gonzales on New Year's Eve. However, we do know that he was driving an electric Ford F-150. And when I looked it up yesterday, there's basically no way he could have made it from Houston to New Orleans without charging that truck at least once.
Okay.
So that, I don't want to speculate. However, at some point he had to have stopped and plugged that truck in order to make it to New Orleans.
Would that be at somebody's home or at a charging station, or do you know?
Honestly, I don't know. And we don't have any photos or videos of that. I'm sure the FBI does.
You see that keen investigative mind working here, right, Devin?
Yeah, I mean, you're just going to have to. This is one of those like kind of wait and see things. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are thousands of hours of videos and photos. And, you know, everybody's got a camera on their house or on their doorbell these days. So I cannot imagine how many videos are out there of this guy.
One thing, and you can take us through January 1st when we come back, because we could do traffic right now, but and the day of the attack. But one thing I still don't understand was why he waited until 3:15 in the morning. And I guess they're still trying to figure that out. But you can pick it up at 12:39 a.m. on the 1st when we come back about the truck and the coolers in the bed turning off a north rampart on the Governor Nichols in the Quarter. 8:50, 10 till 9, more with Devin Bartolotta, the timeline of the Bourbon Street attack in detail when we return on WWL. Right now, a look at traffic. 8:55, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Devin Bartolotta, WWL Louisiana reporter and anchor. She's pieced together with EarthCam live stream video and a producer at Channel 4, the Bourbon Street attackers' actions. Let's pick it up January 1st, 2025, the morning of the attack, Devin. I also want to focus really on the EarthCam stuff and how these coolers got moved around. So go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts of this. It's something that the FBI was not able to release, but we were able to find. So I guess we'll start at the beginning here. This is January 1st, 2025, 12:39 a.m. And what we're doing here is taking everything that the FBI has released, every photo, every video that we have of the attacker, and piecing it together chronologically. It took hours and hours, but it was worth it to kind of understand how the movement started. And if you're listening to this, I wish I had a map to show you. So please just, I guess, imagine as best you can. So 12:39, we know that he's at Governor Nichols and North Rampart, parks the car nearby. That's kind of on the eastern, more residential part of the French Quarter, and then walks down Governor Nichols Street onto Bourbon Street. So the first time that we know right now that he was on Bourbon Street was 1:48 a.m. and he's dragging an ice chest on wheels down Bourbon Street. There's two videos of him doing that. One of them, he's a little bit closer to Orleans, and then he drags it a little bit closer down to kind of closer to St. Peter Street. And this is really strange. We see him on video that the FBI released. He waves for kind of a long time. He waves at a camera or waves down the street, and then turns around and leaves the cooler and heads back in the direction of Governor Nichols. So that's cooler number one. And the waving is still unexplained. A lot of people have asked me about it, and I don't know if it was a wave to kind of make it look more natural that he was leaving the cooler, you know, like he was saying he saw someone and was leaving, or if he was deliberately waving at the earth cam that is parked at that location.
All right, cooler number two.
Cooler number two, is at 2:20 a.m., so about 25 minutes later, and that gets placed at Bourbon and Toulouse. And we don't have timestamps of the video, the videos and the pictures on the Earth Cam. However, you can see that cooler really clearly on the Earth Cam in several photos, and there are crowds of people. I mean, you've seen Bourbon Street on a big night. Crowds of people inches away from this cooler that was packed with explosives. And at some point, somebody or multiple people dragged that cooler down the street so that it was originally parked at Bourbon and St. Peter, and it's at Bourbon and Orleans by the time of the attack, because someone unrelated to the crime, the FBI has cleared them, drug this cooler almost a full block.
Which was loaded with a bomb.
Yes, loaded with a bomb, and we know that there was all kinds of shrapnel inside as well.
Devin, let me just move ahead here because we only have 2 minutes left. One thing I'm wondering about is how did the police, or do we know how the FBI got from. A guy drives his truck past a police car down Bourbon Street, runs people over, hits the lift hoist or whatever you call that thing, gets out, starts shooting the police, kill him. How did they then backtrack to the coolers and explosive devices?
So that was interesting, and we kind of got some clues by listening to the dispatch calls, which tell us that, first of all, we see on the Earth Cam that they cleared the street. So the cooler that we know it is at Bourbon and Orleans is still there, and the street is clear, and there are police everywhere. Then we see the police kind of close in on it in another screenshot from the Earth Cam. And then at 3:44 a.m., we hear on dispatch a first responder is requesting a bomb dog. We don't know if that's for cooler number one or cooler number two, but at some point in that hour, they discovered one of the bombs.
Devin, y'all have done remarkable work at Channel 4. I don't know if this helps or not. Somebody texted in and said Tanger Outlet has car chargers in Gonzales. I don't know if that helps or not with Earth Cam. I just thought I'd pass it along. Thank you.
Oh,
I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Have
you
a good
day. Y'all do a great job. Devin Bartolotto, WWL Louisiana reporter and anchor. We're going to come back. Talk about how people like the attacker become radicalized, and can they become de-radicalized after they've gone down that rabbit hole? Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. As well, there are, I think, in a lot of ways, more unanswered questions than answered about the terrorist attack on Bourbon Street. And the other thing is that there are some big, giant events coming up in the city. With that, we're joined by Gina Ligon, director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation, Technology, and Education Center, NCITE, at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Is it Dr. Ligon?
It is. I'm the director of INSIGHT, which is the Department of Homeland Security's Academic Center for Terrorism Research, and we're headquartered at University of Nebraska.
Let's talk about terrorism. A lot of people tend to think that it's all automatically associated with radical Islam, which it can be, but it's not always that, right? Or not even the majority is that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, any radical extremist religious extremism is some of the most lethal, and there's lots of different religions that can inspire it. But yeah, I mean, we've seen an increase, especially since, honestly, October 7th and the increased tensions of Hamas and the conflict with Israel. And so an increase in that kind of inspired attacks based on that sort of violent interpretation of that religion.
But it's not necessarily religious. It can also be political. Does it skew one way or the other recently in terms, and does the COVID lockdown have anything to do with this, Doctor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, in the U.S., most of the security apparatus has talked about that actually white supremacy is the most lethal kind of ideology that inspires homegrown terrorists in the United States. And so, it ranges from lots of different belief systems. And I think what we get most concerned about as terrorism scholars is really when people feel like they have to take on violent acts to enact whatever those goals are, whether they be political or religious or, you know, even to your point, issue specific, like, you know, climate change. That could also be one that you're going to see an increase in.
Yeah, or abortion or any social issue, it could be, right, where people get, they feel, and that's where we get to the psychology of this, and that's what I want to really get into. How does somebody go from, and in this case, of, and there's so many questions about the Bourbon Street terrorist, but, you know, having financial setbacks, having trouble with the marriage, whatever it was, then from there, it seems to me, and I'm just, a dumb guy, Doctor, but I'm being honest. I would think, well, you know, I don't want to take responsibility for my own problems. I want to blame it on somebody else. So then I'm going to go find somewhere to blame it. And then I'm really going to swallow all of it that I can. And then I'm going to exact that anger and that revenge on somebody that has nothing to do with my problems. Am I even close to anything there or not?
You know, you really just summarized it really well.
Really?
And one of the things that these groups overseas have done just a masterful job at is sort of helping people tie their personal grievances to something bigger than themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have financial trouble or divorces, but when they also have this interaction with, they start consuming this material online, they realize that, you know, they can you know, killed themselves, hurt other people in a way that seems to be more glory filled, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, it, you know, seems to be tied to a higher purpose.
Glory-filled. That's what I just said, gore. I got you. Glory-filled. Yes, exactly. Like they're serving a, it's not just about me. Now I am doing something grand almost to make up for my failures on a personal end.
I think that's it, especially when you look at this person's background. I mean, it's kind of a textbook case of radicalization because he, you know, started, you know, first experimenting with, he converted in 2022, became more of a devout Muslim, I would say, in 2022. That's not what it takes to become a terrorist, right? But what I think was also interesting is you saw that he started isolating himself from people who weren't who he saw as devout. And so then you're cut off from all your social supports and people that might actually help you reinterpret, you know, feelings that you have. And so I think all of those things sort of combined with his financial struggles and then consuming this propaganda really kind of propelled him down that radicalization pathway.
When it comes to radicalization, which is the boat and which is the dock? Do radical groups go out recruiting people or looking for people that are in dire straits, or do people that are in dire straits or have problems go looking for radical organizations?
I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing both, right? There's no doubt that there is a concerted effort to recruit and try to find people who could be vulnerable. Especially you're seeing a lot with young people, with the unmoderated sort of gaming platforms. You have all types of extremists that are trying to reach in and find people to help them be part of something. But I think, you know, from everything we've seen in the FBI files of the attacker in New Orleans, he sought them out. There was no direct recruitment of him, at least from reporting that I've seen. He's the one who really found their websites and tried to understand operational manuals that they had put forth. And so he looked for it.
So I know you guys have done case studies of this, I'm sure. And it goes back to the old thing, Doctor, where individuals are unpredictable, groups of people are predictable. What are some commonalities when it comes to all radicalized terrorists, I guess, whatever the cause?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting. Department of Homeland Security has these things, suspicious activity indicators, mm-hmm. and it's really more based on the mobilization part. Because here's the thing, in the United States, you can hold all the radical beliefs you want, right? Like, right. We have First Amendment. We're able to, you know, express our beliefs, freedom of expression. But it's when people start mobilizing to violence on behalf of those beliefs, there's some more commonalities around that that I think are important for people to really understand. You know, one of them is, you know, isolation from previous groups. And you know, that alone is not a predictor. But when you start looking at it compared, you know, combined with all the other things, you know, I'm just reading about his operational planning, even around the Mardi Gras parade. I don't know if you all are reporting that, but the FBI released a report yesterday that talked about he was actually researching balconies that he could get access to during Mardi Gras this year. Mm-hmm. So when you start doing that kind of operational planning for violence, that there are indicators that are more common for radicalized violent ideologues like him.
What are some other commonalities?
Obsession with violence. So you saw one of the things that he did was he every time for the past 3 months leading up to it, he when there was a shooting in New Orleans in the city, he would research it and try to find out as much as he could about it. So, you know, why was a guy from Houston researching shootings in New Orleans? Mm-hmm. There's even evidence that he had a Google alert for it. So he, you know, he wanted to know every shooting that happened in your city. You know, the other piece I think is interesting is, you know, obsession with previous attacks. And so you saw him looking at, if you remember the vehicle ramming in Germany that was 10 days before his in New Orleans.
Market,
and he, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mark Berg. And he you know, researched everything he could about that, read every news story he could. And so that's another one, his obsession with prior attacks that, and then, you know, a predictor of that. And then also I think it's combined with his radical beliefs and isolation from people that, were former sort of social supports to him. So what we look for is a change in behavior, right? So you saw a distinct change that started happening in 2024 when he became like really interested in the violent extremist content associated with Islam and not the simple religious doctrine associated with it.
So how do you balance that with the rights that we have in America, rights to privacy, rights to freedom of expression, and people that want something like this prevented? Because as you said, Doctor, I can go online, I can say anything I want within reason, I guess. You know, there are some words that, some things that will get me in trouble, threats, et cetera. But also when it comes to changes in behavior or trying to organize people, I don't know how you would go about even as with the Department of Homeland Security and from a psychological standpoint, trying to predict this, trying to follow this, trying to prevent this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if all of it is a law enforcement approach, right? Like if we're trying to arrest our way out of it, we're not going to succeed with this new way that the Islamic State and groups overseas are sort of inspiring attacks here. Like you just can't, because we have civil rights and civil liberties, and it's hard to know when people make that shift from holding an extreme belief to wanting to take on violence on behalf of it. So one of the things that I think is pretty cool that DHS has done, and actually I looked right before the call, New Orleans has one. They have these regional prevention coordinators, and they are people that are really trying to prevent people from ever wanting to mobilize to violence. So it's not like a law enforcement approach. It's more of a off-ramps, you know, helping people understand like how to provide supports. You know, maybe if Jafar's family had encountered any of those programs, and they're in place in Houston as well, they would have, you know, had some tools to be able to off-ramp him from this, as opposed to like having to arrest him, because he, you know, people that probably didn't have probable cause to arrest him, you know, as according to our First Amendment rights.
So when it comes to the internet, naturally the internet facilitates most of this, right? That was the game changer when it comes to radicalization and terror groups reaching out and finding individuals, or individuals reaching out and finding terror groups?
Yeah, and I honestly think it's on behalf of the foreign terrorist groups of recognizing they could change their propaganda to what we call enable terrorist attacks. So it's not just inspiring them, right? It's not just like talking about radical violent beliefs, but it's actually giving them operational manuals and making people feel like they have the ability to carry out these attacks. And so we call those enabled attacks. So there's, you know, three different categories. There's inspired, there's enabled, and then there's directed. And I would classify him as enabled, because he, it looks like what he was doing was actually looking at operational manuals, not just, radical sermons and things like that. Like he was getting some what we would perceive to be direction, but not from a person, just from the materials.
So I'm trying to, I have so many questions here, and not specifically about this Bourbon Street attacker, because I know that the investigation is ongoing. But when it comes to locations, for example, why would somebody choose not to engage in, and I'm going to make it about New Orleans, Doctor, and I don't mean to, but just as an analogy.
No, it's fine.
As an analogy, it's like, why would he pick New Orleans? Why not do something in Houston? Why do terrorists pick the locations, and how do they go about that? Is there a commonality there at all, Venn diagrams?
Yeah, that's a great question, because like if you just look at it straight from like a criminology perspective, like the way criminologists think about crime, usually you would want to, there's a theory called routine activities theory, right? Which is you're more likely to commit a crime in a place that you have routine contact with, because you have more expertise in how to carry it out. He traveled there, right? And, used the meta glasses to be able to scope it out. He thought about renting an apartment. If you saw on Orleans Street, he did all these things to try to develop expertise with your city. So I thought that was interesting. One of the things that if you backtrack about terrorists, they're trying to get attention for their cause. And so New Orleans, you know, obviously on New Year's Eve would have a lot of people. And he knew that it's a symbolic part of America. And I think that's also important for us to remember is that at the end of the day, he didn't do this quietly, right? He wanted people to cover it and do it on a day that would get the mass media attention. And so I think, you know, most of them do try to choose not only symbolic targets, but also targets that will get a lot of media coverage.
And as we have this conversation, it pops into my mind, maybe he did know that the Super Bowl was coming. Maybe that's that he thought he'd get more publicity that way. Maybe as you talk about Mardi Gras, I knew that was coming up. Maybe he thought that would get more publicity. I still wonder why he waited until 3:15. I don't get that part. But let me get more to the social media sites. And we hear so much about algorithms and the internet. Do they play a part in this? If somebody goes to look for a tweet or a video or research, like we talked about the Christmas market attacks in Germany, I think it was, then is somebody able to track that? And then they say, well, you know what? This person is obviously interested in this, so let's reach out to them and try to radicalize them.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, like from a, like, let's just talk about it from a police interdiction standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like when a lot of Americans, not a lot, but when an alarming number of Americans were wanting to travel to go fight for the Islamic State, you know, there was collaboration with the tech companies about, like, for example, on Google search engine, if people would type in how to get to Syria cheaply, right? That was one of the main routes that people would want to get to go fight for the Islamic State. And so, you know, the dangerous organization's part, and they did have one at Google at the time, was able to redirect those people into different places where they could talk to people that maybe could off-ramp them or give them some other resources to support them. So, you know, we do get smart about search histories and, you know, trying to be able to use it to off-ramp people when we see some sort of known patterns. But I think what's hard about, you know, Jabbar, for example, is that he, you know, he was, you could have just chalked it up to curiosity. He wasn't doing something that looks so like, oh, this is definitely someone who wants to attack. It could have just been someone who was interested in New Orleans, right? Which a lot of us are. So, yeah, I think when it's a very commonly used search term, yes, there are definitely triggers that can help with interdiction and surveillance. But oftentimes, and you know, it's just a needle in a haystack, just like we talk about.
And I just wonder if from the other angle where I'm, you know, okay, let's just look at what happened at the market in the Christmas market. And I keep watching it and watching it. And then some nefarious actor sees or is able to access the data that I'm watching. And they say, well, you know what? If I'm recruiting somebody to become a terrorist, maybe this person would be subject to that. Does it happen that way as well?
Yeah, most of them are not as sophisticated to be able to like track the metrics of who's looking. Mm-hmm. But here's what they do is when you like things, like, for example, if you follow accounts or you even just like a news article or write a comment, that there is evidence that that certainly can trigger recruiters to target you and start sending you more material. The other is in those unmoderated spaces that we talked about, like Telegram and channels that are in, you know, when you join those chat rooms. I haven't seen any reporting about him that he was actually in any of those. But if you're in any of those, that can also be a way that they can try to recruit you. And there's, you know, there was a whole apparatus from ISIS, I mean, doing that where they were recruiting women and Westerners to want to come over and be part of that just by like how their behavior was online.
I get a text that comes in here, Doctor. We have a thing where people can text in their thoughts. And somebody said he was radicalized by a religious sect that hates America. Why isn't that the main point of discussion? Mm. And I think that that's what the discussion is about. He went to the religion or the radical religious sect that hates America because of his issues, not the other way around. Correct? I mean, that's the point we're making here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not a linear pathway, unfortunately, but there are sort of like, I would say kind of like levers that are operating all together, right? So that's the risk factor you pointed out at the beginning about his financial troubles. Also, you know, wanting to be part of something bigger. I mean, there's evidence of him wanting to join groups, as you saw with his military history. So he no longer had a group, and so he's lonely. And then he finds this, you know, radical interpretation of a religion. And, you know, that's the problem, is you can make any belief system radical, you know, and that's an issue that we struggle with as terrorism researchers. You may have a belief about climate change or the way the government handles, you know, state rights or gun rights. But, you know, when you start deciding you have to take on violence because of that, that's when you become what we would call, you know, an extreme violent ideologue. And the ideology could be anything. It could be religion, issue specific, political. People can contort all kinds of things to justify violent action. And I think you're seeing that with him.
Can social media companies inadvertently make this worse by feeding you more of what you like, going back to the algorithm thing where, well, they're not necessarily nefarious actors. They're just, you know, the algorithms are showing what you like, so they send you more. And then before you know it, like, you know, use the old cliche of the frog in the water, where before you know it, you're suddenly radicalized because you kept getting fed. You're being fed all of this stuff over and over and from more and more sources.
Yeah, and I think especially if you don't have any other sources of contradictory information, right? Like, you saw him isolating from, you know, people that didn't have those extreme beliefs. And so you're getting this consumption due to algorithms of things getting promoted over and over again. You're seeing the same TikToks or Instagram reels over and over again, and you no longer have that support group to kind of bring you back and pull you back to being less extreme in that interpretation of Islam.
Doctor, I hope you come back, because we never have enough time, but I do have to ask this. Once somebody goes down the rabbit hole and becomes radicalized, is there an off-ramp to that, or is that it?
Gosh, I have to believe there is, or I wouldn't be doing this, right?
What has the research shown and success rates?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a really cool book called Walking Away from Terrorism. It's by John Horgan, and it's all about different kind of disengagement or off-ramp pathways. But, you know, I have to go back, and part of this is probably because I'm a psychologist, but, you know, having what we call intimate partners, friends and family, social networks. Number one, recognize the change in behavior and some of these risk factors. But then number two, help pull you back without a law enforcement kind of option, right? So it's more about like bringing you back into the fold socially, as opposed to trying to, you know, call the police about you or call the FBI about you. When you see cases like that, we call that a better pathway for what I would call disengagement, maybe, which is different than de-radicalization, because I just want them to disengage with a violence. You know, again, I live in Nebraska, and I'm a, you know, First Amendment protected. Like, you can have all the extreme beliefs you want in America, but if you act violently on behalf of them, that's when you become a concern to public safety. And so I just want them to disengage from the violent interpretation and sort of the operational manuals about how to mobilize to act out.
It would seem like once law enforcement gets involved, it's almost too late.
I mean, you say that, but, like, you know, one of the things that I wanted to point out was, you know, there's been 23 attacks that have been in last year that were stopped by different parts of law enforcement that were inspired by the Islamic State. And so, you know, America doesn't hear about those as much.
Yeah.
They have, you know, law enforcement has to be right 100% of the time.
But
this guy, you know, got through, but
I think that's
stopped quite a few.
A very good point, Dr. Ligon, and that is that we don't know what we don't know, and we know about the ones that fail, but we have no idea about the ones that were stopped, right?
Yeah, you can kind of get a sense of it from arrest records. That's one of the things that we track is, and, you know, sometimes they roll them up on charges like gun charges or pornography or something not related to terrorism, but that, you know, because they just want to get them off the street and get them out of, you know, harming Americans. And so they're going to look for whatever crime they can prosecute. So the number is kind of an undercount. Like, a lot of times the media doesn't even pick up on it because it's, you know, so-and-so was arrested from a big cache of weapons that they were that they had. And you might not think about that with terrorism, but in all actuality, that person was maybe consuming extremist propaganda, and we didn't hear that part of the case.
Doctor, did you write a book about de-radicalization or not?
No, I have not. But you know, in our consortium, we fund a lot of research looking at like how you reintegrate people back into society after they've been part of groups. So we are definitely trying to put the full court press on trying to understand how you pull people out, because I think that a lot of us unfortunately know people that perhaps have changed their behavior in terms of, you know, consuming more extreme beliefs. And so what can we do as parents, as siblings, as, you know, friends to pull people back into the fold so they don't, you know, go down that hole of getting engaged in violence?
And the book you mentioned was Walking Away from Terrorism by whom?
His name's John Horgan. He's a really prolific terrorism researcher, but he's interviewed a lot of former extremists from, you know, Salafi jihadists all the way to like members of the IRA and like how they got out of terrorist groups. And so I just find that really hopeful because you can kind of start putting patterns together. But I think the common denominator is having that social network to pull you back. And so if anything, you know, just giving your listeners that efficacy to, you know, that we all play a part in our public safety and to not. And if you have that kind of spider sense, trust it, you know.
Doctor, I can't thank you enough for your time. I hope you come back and have another conversation with us because I can only talk to you for about 20 straight hours about this. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for covering it.
Hope you come back. Thank you, Dr. Gina Ligon, Director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, who incidentally has the initials UNO. 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We always do this every year. We talk with the executive director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We're very appreciative of everything that law enforcement does. And with that, we welcome in Rosa Gwixens. Did I say that right, Rosa?
Yes, Gwixens. Yes, sir.
Gwixens,
thank you
executive
for having
director.
Me,
thank you. Tell me about the numbers of 2024 as far as law enforcement deaths compared to 2023?
So sadly, once again, in 2024, we saw an increase in line of duty deaths. We had a total of 147 line of duty deaths, which is a 25% increase from 2023. 52 of those 147 cases were gunfire-related fatalities, which is also an increase of about 13% from what we saw in 2023. That does not include the number of officers. I just like to point this out. It doesn't include the number of officers that were shot and survived and shot at. So it's a astounding number. The highest number of officers that were killed due to firearm related incidents was while they were doing traffic enforcement or trying to arrest people or serving warrants.
I just want to point out for a second there, Rosa, for people that think there's when they get pulled over by the police, you know, everybody's nervous there. You're not just the only one that's nervous, the law enforcement officer. And when you look at 9 killed just during what was supposed to be a, quote, routine traffic stop or trying to make an arrest or even serving a warrant or eviction, the officer doesn't know what's on the other side of that. And people need to keep that in mind, right?
100%. We have no idea who we're pulling over, what's in the vehicle. You know, the time of day also helps, whether it's daylight out or night out, especially in the evening, if tinted windows, we can't see inside the vehicle. I tell my children, the side of the road is not the place to argue. That's what court is for. So just be respectful, do what you're told. Follow directions and everything will be fine.
And along those lines, officers do get, and I try to make it as safe for an officer when I get pulled over as I can to pull as far over on the road and to give him as, or her as much room as they need. That's a very dangerous thing as well, is it not? Traffic related?
Well, actually, it's crazy that you mentioned that in particular because that's where we saw a 113% increase in our fatalities, which is the struck by category. Struck bys are what we refer to as when officers are out of their vehicle, either off their motorcycle or they're just not protected in any way. They're standing on the side of the road. And that could be directing traffic even. but we had a 113% increase from last year. 17 officers were killed as struck flies, which is terrifying. I mean, speed kills. People are driving distracted. People are driving impaired. People are not minding move over laws, and it's killing a lot of police officers.
I know that I once helped a lady change a tire on the side of the interstate, and I was Catholic at that time and said like 15 acts of contrition. So I can only imagine what y'all go through. Let me take a break, Rose. When we come back, I want to talk about the other causes of death. And I don't want to focus on the anomaly as much as just the dangers of being a law enforcement officer that I don't think people realize. And we'll talk about that. 49 other causes of death in 2024, traffic-related deaths. We talked about 52 firearms fatalities, and the numbers, I'll give you the total, the most frequent, I guess. Traffic enforcement was at the top, then making an arrest. Civil papers are serving warrants or an eviction, investigating suspicious persons. 5 ambushes, 4 were handling domestic disturbance calls. 4 were killed during technical encounters. 3 were killed in accidental and inadvertent shootings. 2 investigating disturbance calls. 2 were off-duty robbery intervention where the officer was off-duty. 1 was shot in a vehicle pursuit. We'll talk about the other causes and the dangers of law enforcement. To law enforcement when we return. 947, 13 till 10. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, quickly back with Rosa Gwixens, who has 30 years in law enforcement. She's the executive director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We've been doing this maybe 10 years now, talking about the number of deaths in law enforcement when the numbers come out. 2024, seeing a 25% increase in law enforcement deaths compared to 2023. Rose, if we can quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left, let's get to the other causes. And I'm not trying to cite them as anomalies, but only to show how varied and dangerous the role of law enforcement can be.
Yes, thank you, Tommy. So in that category, the cases that are included in those are the long-term illnesses that are related to the 9/11 terror attacks, any acute medical events that are brought on by extreme stressful events, and then a variety of other rare incidents like electrocution or any fire-related case. Actually, the state of Louisiana had 2 physical related. So I'm going out on a limb and just saying it's probably some sort of heart attack, cardiac type of medical event. There were 36 total for 2024. Then 4 drowned. A few of those were actually training incidents. So they were training for whether it be to get into a specialized unit or whatever the case was. 4 were beaten to death. 2 were in an airplane crash, 2 were stabbed, 1 was a fire-related incident, and 1, as I mentioned, was an electrocution. So it's certainly, it's a variety of incidents that fall in that category.
Thank you so much for the time and for the work that law enforcement does. Rosa Gwixens, Executive Director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. I hope when we speak next year, there is a decrease in 2024 compared to 2025.
That would be-
You know what I'm saying. Thank you, Rosa. 954, back in a flash, WWL.